You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
This is obviously quite a heavy event, revolving around a massacre in the midst of a brutal civil war, the killing of hundreds of civilians in Dos Aires, and the deaths and disappearance of hundreds of thousands over the course of a 3-decades-long war. So we're going to start and put a few clips throughout, borrowing from some of the great work that was done by ProPublica and This American Life, amongst others. So, Caroline?
To supporting these repressive but anti-communist regimes. In Guatemala, the war heats up. There's this village in the panhandle near Mexico called Dos Aires. And in late 1982, there's an ambush by the guerrillas in that area, and that's kind of a humiliating defeat for the military. The Cayrillas are U.S.-trained commando unit, insular, fierce, incredibly adept at what they do, up close, hands-on killing. These guys go in, these commandos, and they round these people up and systematically kill them and dump them in this well. They basically just kill the entire population. Wholesale annihilation. But then you have this remarkable thing where you have two small boys turn up and who they spare. These kids are brought home by these two soldiers and raised in their families. This case is extraordinary for a number of reasons. One of them is there are two repentant members of the squad. And within a few minutes, he starts talking about Dos Aires, and the whole story comes pouring out of him. And he starts crying as he tells the story about killing the baby, as he was crying back then. And at some point he says, "I knew this day would come." And all of a sudden,
So with the heaviness of the massacre and the war, we're also at the same time grateful to be able to center this event around some hopeful stories. One, and obviously the centerpiece here, is the discovery of Oscar Ramirez's identity and the reunion of Oscar with his father. Oscar is obviously one of the only surviving members of the Dos Aires massacre. And his father had thought that his entire family had perished. And the other hopeful events are renewed efforts at transparency and accountability, which our speakers here are centrally implicated in, which they'll speak about. There's no easy gloss. There are tremendous challenges, which they will discuss, but they're nonetheless definitive steps forward. So to introduce this panel, Oscar Ramirez's remarkable story is what unites us here today. He is a Guatemalan living in Massachusetts who, over the last year, has gone through a tremendous turn of events, learning that he was a survivor of this 1982 massacre in which 250 men, women, and children perished. In the short time that Oscar has had his life turned upside down, he's apparently not thought twice about jumping headfirst into serving as a witness in human rights prosecutions. And his testimony has already helped secure a harsh sentence for a former Kabyle who had been fraudulently seeking sanctuary in the United States. Freddie Petrarelli, on the far end of the table, is the executive director of the phenomenal Guatemalan Forensic Anthropology Foundation and has led the search for an exhumation of remains of many of the victims of atrocities, including those at Dos Aires. Freddie is leading painstaking, risky, and tireless efforts to exhume and identify the bodies of victims of the war. He's conducted over 1,000 investigations, recovered more than 6,000 bodies, over 98% victims of state action, and identified through various different mechanisms, which I'm sure he'll speak about today, over 1,800 of them. The foundation's work is crucial for the advancement of ongoing and future prosecutions, and his leadership in Guatemala is a model for other forensic anthropology efforts around the world. Kate Doyle, to my right, is a senior analyst at the National Security Archive, an independent non-governmental research institute and library located at George Washington University. Among other things, she's led efforts to obtain the declassification of U.S. government archives in support of investigations and truth commissions in Latin America, including documents establishing that U.S. officials were aware that the Guatemalan army may have committed a massacre at Dos Aires, and obtained records from state security agencies outside of the United States. The unparalleled role that she has played in Guatemala and elsewhere is evidenced by the fact that she has been the trusted recipient of critical leaked documents whose existence had been denied by the Guatemalan government for years, documents which are now crucial documents supporting human rights litigation in Guatemala and internationally. And Scott Greathead on my left is a lawyer and human rights activist who has been representing Oscar in his U.S. asylum claim and has been active in human rights work across Latin America for decades. The heaviness of the subject is also lightened by the effectiveness of the asylum application. Oscar and Scott just learned at the end of last week that his asylum application has been granted, so there's something very concrete that we can celebrate today. So the work of Scott alongside Oscar, Freddie, and others has secured a bit of peace and safety for Oscar and his family. So without further ado, as Oscar is obviously one of the main reasons that many of us are here today, I'm going to turn to Oscar and first offer huge congratulations to you and your family and to all of us who now have you alongside us here in the United States more comfortably. But can you say something about how the events transpired over the last year that led you to discover that you were one of the few survivors of the Dos Aires massacre?
Sure, thank you. Thanks everybody for being here. This started last year. There were some people from some persecutors from Guatemala, from the public ministry. They were looking for me in an old town where I grew up, and they were looking for this guy that it could be one of survivors from the massacre that occurred in those areas of Guatemala. But at that point, I was already here, and they approached to some of my families from Guatemala. They don't have too much information about me, and they send them to the my wife's parents, where they ask for me, and they tell them that they couldn't say where I was because they didn't know what they were looking for me. So my wife's parents call me and saying that there is some people from the public minister looking for you, and they want to talk to you. And I was like, why are they looking for me? I don't have any problems over there. Why they should be looking for me? And they say, they left the phone number here, and you can call them, but they say it was very important. I don't think that they looking because you are in trouble or something, but they say it was something important they would like to talk to me. So these people left the phone number with my wife's parents, and they give me the number, and I called them from about a week after. And I called this lady, Sara Romero, who was one of the persecutors over in Guatemala. And first she asked me if they were looking for this guy, and they have suspect that I could be the guy that they were looking for. And at the beginning, they were trying to find out if we were brothers with another guy on Canada, Ramiro Romero. They suspected that we could be brothers, but in order to determine if we were brothers, they need to do a DNA test. In order to do the DNA test, I have to approve them to make this test. So after that, she said, for explain me a little bit better, she will send me an email explain me why they were looking for me, the main reasons why they think that I could be that guy. So after I read an email, we get in contact again, and I tell them that I was agreed to get a DNA test. By that time, Freddie was here with New York with another, was his workers, with Jessica. and lucky that they were around here, and he agreed to come all the way up to Framingham to take the DNA samples for me. So finally, Freddie get to my house, and he start to explain me what they will be doing. He take the samples, and they told me that they will call me back with the results. And after a while, they call me back, but I asked Freddie too if could be he will know somebody that could help me to fix my situation over here in the USA. And he said, I may know somebody, but I'm not sure yet. He said, was talking about Scott at that time, but we didn't know him so much. And after a while, he called me with the results. He called me and he said that he has his results already, and he compared the DNA with Ramiro, but he said we weren't brothers. Like, it was a huge gap that we couldn't be brothers, so I was like, you know, kind of what I was expecting to happen, because I didn't know in the town where I grew up. I mean, they grew me up as the own family. If it wouldn't be for all this investigation, I probably will never find out that I was like adopted from them, because some of them not even know. They thought that I was like they own nephew. So when this happened, he say, you guys not brother, but I told him that was okay. And then he say, I'm not done yet. He say, we compare with some other person. Let me tell you that Oscar, the guy that you've been thinking it was your father, he's not your father. He just adopted you. And we found your biological father. And your biological father is a guy called Tranquilino Castañeda. Up at that point, I didn't have not much to say. I didn't know what to say. After he told me with the dates, we make a Skype conversation with my biological father, seeing for the first time each other by the computer. And that was about very much what all this happening during this last year. And then Scott helped me to fill the application for the asylum, and then as a result, we already granted the asylum. It was very good. It's been very good after that. And that was about what been happened all this year since we found each other.
Quite a story, and obviously just the beginning or the middle of a much longer story. If people have seen the This American Life episode or read the ProPublica piece, the primary article and the primary episode in What Happened at Dos Aires describes the discovery of your identity, but it leaves off when you're expecting to meet your father, and you're expecting him to join you in Massachusetts. So we have a clip of your family being reunited that we're going to show.
Sé que siempre se siente porque se murieron mucho, pero ya ahora ya me calmo un poquito por la razón que hay familia, ya nos reconocimos. ¿Sí?
Ahí viene, ahí viene, ahí viene, ahí viene, ahí viene.
Entonces. Ha cambiado, o sea, de una manera muy bonita nuestra vida porque tenemos otro miembro en nuestra familia en lo que se refiere a sangre de parte de Oscar.
Papa, 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 dice, ¿no? Papa, papa, dice.
¿Qué dice papa?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was like, you know, very nervous, very anxious. I just want to see him come out that door.
Será por el momento, pero sí me aprecian. No, estaban ellos ansiosos de que yo me viniera. Ah, yo me sentí feliz hasta derramé lágrimas de él y conmigo ahí porque nos juntamos ahí como los días, no visto por fotos nada más.
Felices también porque va a estar ahora con nosotros. Nosotros lo queremos tener con nosotros para cuidarlo, para atenderlo, para darle quizás el amor, especialmente familia, y la atención que tal vez nadie le pudo dar por haberse quedado solo. Y eso se lo queremos dar nosotros a él.
I definitely cried watching that the first time, and it was not the first time that I cried knowing, following your story, and I can't imagine how that encounter was for your family and also for your father. Is there something that you'd like to share about that encounter and how that's affected your family?
Well, it didn't affect me. Affected in the good sense of the word. I don't have the words to describe that. I mean, it's very, very happy, very... I couldn't believe what happened at that moment. I really don't have the words to explain that. It's just, we were very happy. My kids was very happy to see the grandpa. And my wife was very happy too, after we find out all this. No words to explain that. It's just very happy to be reunited with a father that I didn't know that I have. He doesn't have, he had a son too. After he lost, he lost 8 more than his wife, and he thought that he was lost all of them. So very happy to be reunited with them.
Scott has been describing to me some of the incredible work that you've been engaged in to immediately get involved in helping to hold perpetrators of human rights violations in Guatemala accountable. Can you describe a little bit your experience as a witness in prosecutions and what your expectation is in that regard moving forward?
Well, yes. We having some conversation with the Justice Department that's been persecuting these other persons have been participating in that massacre. And yes, they asked me if I could go to be a witness on these cases. But I told them, obviously, I cannot be a witness that I see or I remember or I can say something, but I will be a living proof that this happened there, and nothing more witness than being living proof that you belong to that part of the world. So yes, we will be willing to do a witness stuff on these cases.
Thank you, Oscar.
Thank you.
Freddie, can you describe a little bit how you got involved in this story and how you continue to be involved in this story?
Well, good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you to OSI for inviting us once again. I was here last year in June for the Human Rights Watch Film Festival when Granito, a movie by... Pamela Yates and Paco de Onís were showing. We got together with Kate and many of the other granitos in the movie, and right before I came up, I was asked by the prosecution to see if I could go up to Framingham, Massachusetts to take a sample. I was like, Framingham, Massachusetts, where's that? And I said, well, how about you have this person come to New York? He could come see Granito, was my idea. And they said he wasn't willing to come, and I understood really quickly. So we got a GPS and found Framingham. But along the way, I met someone that has changed my life and Oscar's. And it happened through another friend, who's Almudena Bernabeu, who's not here, who's in the movie Granito, who's a lawyer, who's actually heading the case of genocide in the Spanish courts. She also comes out in the movie. And she put me in touch with Scott to see if he would help us set up a 501c3, a nonprofit organization here in New York called Friends of FAFG, which Scott has done. And although that's the reason why we initially met, it has become secondary to both of our interests, at least during the last year. One of the things that Scott said to me, he said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to convince my board if I'm going to do this pro bono. So, you know, tell me what you do and, you know, convince me. So I started telling him about the work. And, you know, I usually get excited when I speak of all the stuff that we've been doing the last 20 years. And then I said, and on Monday, I'm going to be driving up, Sunday, over the weekend, I'm going to be driving up to this little town, Framingham, which I believe is outside of Boston somewhere. And apparently, there's a young man who is a survivor of the Dos Erres massacre. And Scott's eyes opened up, and immediately, you know, I told him, we're going to take a DNA sample. We think we have his father. And he might also be related to another kid, in another young man in Canada. And Scott interrupted me and said, listen, if you identify this guy through DNA, you tell him that I will represent him in his asylum application. And that was in the first 5 minutes of our conversation. And so I went up to see Oscar, and I had a lot of questions, especially about how he was treated because of other cases like this one in Guatemala. And he told me the story. It was very different from the beginning, and how much he identified with his, I call it, abductive family. You know, I told him everything we did. I gave him a foundation hat, which I usually do. And we began to talk. He established a conversation almost on a weekly basis with our investigator, Jessica. He was very eager. Initially, he was very calm, but then he became very eager. He wanted to know. And I told him, I said, listen, we might have a lawyer for you if you happen to be the son of this guy and a survivor of Dos Erres massacre. August, I don't remember the date, August 7th or 8th, we got the results. But before, you know, and the DNA results were very clear. You know, he wasn't the brother, but he was the son of this other man who had survived the massacre because he wasn't there. But before I called Oscar, I wrote Scott. And I said, Scott, remember what you said? If, you know, if this guy happened to be, that you were going to represent him, you know, can I take your word? I'm going to call this guy tonight. And I need to tell him not only that we found his father, but I think because of the immigration situation, we need to know if he has some hope of remaining in this country legally because of who he is. And Scott said, yes, I'm. Tell him that, yes, I represent them, and we just need to find out a couple of more details. And so I called Oscar, and we spoke. It was late at night, and I remember he really couldn't believe it because he thought he hung up the phone, and it must have been his wife. He must have turned over to Nidia and said, I found my father. And the weird thing was he wasn't really looking for his father, and he thought his father was dead. But the man who he thought his father wasn't his biological father. From then on, we you know, talked quite a bit with Scott, tried to get the information ready, and ever since we've become friends. I feel very fortunate to be a very small part of this whole thing that I think started with Almudena and now is continuing on with other people. It's a series of events that has led us now not only to find Oscar, but now to have his asylum application approved. And I think it's the beginning of a new life for him. And I'm honored to be here with him in the same table. It's a real honor.
Story for you because you're often dealing with people who have not survived in the forensic anthropology work that you do. We wanted to show a little bit of a clip, and then I know you have some information that you want to share about some of the other work that the foundation is engaged in now.
Well, most of the mass graves that we've dug up during the last 19 years are in the communities in the Highlands, and these are the victims of massacres. But recently, we've also found that a lot of the bodies of the people that were forcibly disappeared, after they were tortured, interrogated, tortured, they were executed and thrown in the streets of cities, Guatemala City being one of these cities. And then the bodies would be autopsied in some cases and taken to cemeteries like La Verbena Cemetery. What we're doing now is we're looking for the bodies of the people that were disappeared and buried as John or Jane Doe's or unidentified bodies. In La Verbena, what happened is after they were buried in individual graves, after some time because of lack of space, they take the bodies out and they throw them in these huge bone wells. There's four of them. So far we've exhumed over 12,500 bodies, and we believe at least 1,000 of those bodies are bodies of victims of forced disappearance.
And the connections to September 11th, every which way, the election that led to the...
That question is not my favorite question from that Democracy Now! Episode, but can you talk a little bit about the broader work of the foundation?
Yes, of course. Let me see if we can... Well, the foundation really has... what we do is we recover the bodies of people that were killed. There we go. That we know were killed or disappeared during the conflict. The foundation really focuses on armed conflict investigations, Guatemalan armed conflict. We look for people that were killed during the conflict and people that were disappeared. And we do this with the objective of dignifying the victims and the families through the identification. But we also provide evidence to the courts, to the prosecutor's office. And that's what we have been doing during the last 20 years, providing evidence, waiting for these cases to make it to court. And finally, in the last 12 months, several cases have made it to court, not only in Guatemala, but also in the inter-American system. Can you go up on that? This is actually the first part of the investigation is when our investigators interview the families, and can you go up on that? No, at all? On that slide? Just like scroll it up a little bit? Because this is actually Oscar's family here. And you can't see him, but Oscar keeps moving. He's down here somewhere. This is Don Tranquilino, and these are Oscar's, the ones in blue are brothers, and the ones in sort of fuchsia our sisters and the mother. Relationships have to be established by our investigators in order for us to know how we're going to compare his DNA to each family. And what we do is we take DNA from the skeletal remains and compare it to the skeletal, to the DNA from the families, put it into a system called a mass fatality identification system, which basically cross-references DNA profiles. And that's how we get these initial matches. What I wanted to show you, why don't you go down some. Lately, we have also, in the clip you saw, work that we're doing with enforced disappearances in the cities. One of the things that we have been doing lately, further down, more, is we have been working in a military base. Further down, right there, that one. This military zone is formerly known as Zone Number 21. It was established in 1971 and worked up till about functioned till about 2004. Currently, it's a regional UN peacekeepers training command center. So they train the blue helmets that are going to serve in Haiti and in Congo. But there was an actual witness who said, you can go to the next one, that there was bodies within this base. And he showed us, go to the next one, six areas. You can't really see that, but some of the areas are here. Actually, seven areas. We have found bodies in two of those seven areas. Actually, the first grave we found 2 hours after we began the investigation. Continue, this is area five here. Go to the next one. It's a shame. And you can see, for example, one of the commanders of this base was interviewed by one of the Guatemalan newspapers, and he said that these people that were buried there were
people from a community of workers that lived within the military base, and this was a community cemetery. But as you can see, we're finding the bodies with ropes, you know, around their ankles, their hands, their legs, their necks. We're finding them with evidence of gunshot wounds to the head. I mean, these are people that were executed. The graves are not organized. They don't show any signs of respect. These are disorganized mass graves of people that were executed. Now, also, what you see in that slide is documents. We found books with official military documents. We began to, at least right now, clean them and scan them. We still don't know what's in them, but the most important thing about the documents is that the military for many years has denied the fact that these documents exist. And now we are finding documents from other military bases in other zones, in other geographical areas, dumped on top of an area where there are graves. So not only did they hide the bodies in those graves, but they're also dumping these, they could be sensitive military documents. And this is evidence that there's a strategy behind this, and that these documents and these graves do exist within military bases. Let's do this one and we'll do the last one. So far here, we have found 62 graves for a total of 409 bodies. And this is in the last 5 months or so. This is by far the largest investigation we've ever conducted in Guatemala, where we know everyone is a victim. And I say that because it's very different from the 12,000 or 14,000 bodies that we've managed to exhume from the local cemeteries. Because in the cemeteries, there's commingling between identified individuals and unidentified individuals. Here, these are hidden bodies within a functioning military installation. We know that these are all victims. It's really important when we look at grave 15, because we found that's the largest grave there, 64 bodies, but it is believed that about 40 of those women and children in that grave were helicoptered in from Rio Negro, from Los Encuentros, which is one of the five Rio Negro massacres. And this is testimony that we've been listening to for the last 20 years. And all of a sudden we open up this grave and we see that there's people in the grave wearing different typical dress than the region that they're in. And everyone from that region recognizes that those people are from Rabinal. The people from Rabinal also came over and said, yes, that clothing is from Rabinal. So initially, the typical clothing is what led us to believe. And when we go back and look at the testimonies from Rio Negro and Plan de Sanchez, everyone always speaks of the women and children that were taken by helicopter to a military base somewhere. And that brings us back to Oscar, you know, the women and the children being taken by helicopter to military bases. And it's similar to the story with a different ending. But overall, what the foundation now focuses on is on this large genetic database that's run with a laboratory. Everything we do is in our own DNA laboratory that's sponsored by the Netherlands and the State Department of the United States. We get no support from the Guatemalan state. Surprise. But the laboratory is for the victims and is accredited under Rule ISO 17025, and that's very important because it's a scientific effort. It's an objective scientific effort that shows the truth of what happened in Guatemala during the conflict, and sometimes we get lucky and we find people like Oscar and they make everything worthwhile. So thank you, and sorry about the unfortunate technical mishap.
Doyle, in your reference to the fact that very rarely documents are made available, and very often the military says documents don't exist, and then you find them in the places that you find them, it seems the crucial documents seem to be most often found in the hands of Kate Doyle when someone transfers them to her, documents that were said to have been destroyed or never to have existed in the first place. So we are going to show one short clip, the last clip from Granito.
'99, I went to Guatemala, and one night in my hotel room, I got a call. And somebody I know wanted to show me something. It was a logbook that documented the capture and, in many of the cases, the execution of 183 people. Essentially, this was an army record of the disappeared.
So can you tell us, Kate, a little bit about your work and the work of the National Security Archive in Guatemala, and in particular, how these kinds of documents and other documents are being used in some of the prosecutions that are ongoing now?
Sure. Thanks, Emmy, and thank you to the Justice Initiative for this invitation to all of us. Well, the National Security Archive was created in the 1980s during the Reagan government, an era of great government secrecy. That was the era of the Iran-Contra scandal. There were many people in the United States who were concerned that U.S. policy was being carried out in their name, but without their knowledge. And that's really the foundation of the National Security Archive. It was created to serve as an advocacy organization for the right of people to know what their government is doing, and a repository or a library of sorts where researchers could come and use declassified documents that we, the analysts, obtained through an aggressive strategy of filing Freedom of Information Act requests. So there are groups of analysts that focus on specific issues of U.S. policy around the world, or themes such as nuclear, the history of nuclear power or nuclear weapons and so forth. That function of the archive, which was really created in a sense to serve Americans, that was the original idea behind the organization, and to push on the door of the right to know in the United States. But that function changed quite dramatically after the end of the Cold War, when people from all around the world began to approach the archive and ask for our advice or orientation or guidance or ideas about how they, in Hungary or Poland or the Czech Republic, could challenge their own legacies of secrecy and repression. How could they dispense with or make accessible in some way or preserve their own secret police archives, their intelligence archives? And could they pass their own freedom of information laws? And that really began a whole new kind of path for the archive's work. And that's where the work of those of us who work in Latin America come in at the archive. Because just around that time, the early 1990s, the late 1980s, as you know, this figure of the Truth Commission began to emerge as one of the key ways that societies could grapple with legacies of state repression and violence. And as Latin America began to sign into being these newly formed truth commissions in countries in which, of course, governments had been for decades not only the engines of repression, but also the enforcers of a kind of deadly silence about what was happening. So silence and ignorance was a part of the repressive project in many of those countries. And the archive found that in places like El Salvador or Guatemala, Argentina, Chile, you name it, where Truth Commission investigators or families of the disappeared or human rights organizations were trying to understand not just what happened to them, because of course they told their stories. They came forward. They gave their testimonies over and over and over again to human rights organizations that would take them down or to anyone that would listen. But how to get to the bottom of the role of the state? How did the state institutions craft and carry out the policy of state terror? And for that, you need state records. You need documents. You need information. And what we realized at the archive is that by tapping into this sort of treasure trove of U.S. secret records from our own CIA or embassy files or defense attachés who would serve in embassies around the world, we found a wealth of information, not only about U.S. policy and what our own policymakers or officials were doing on the ground, but also about the militaries in those countries, the allied militaries in those countries. And so if we couldn't get the records of the Salvadoran armed forces, we could get CIA and embassy cables about our relationship to the armed forces and what they were doing. And that's how this Guatemala project was really launched in the early 1990s when the Guatemalan government and the guerrilla forces signed their first sort of side accord to what would eventually become the peace accords 2 years later on human rights, and that mandated the creation of a truth commission, and the truth commission requested our help. So that's how we began to mine the treasure trove of U.S. documents looking at state repression in Guatemala.
And after decades of foot dragging by prosecutors in Guatemala, there are some really important prosecutions that are ongoing, as well as some work to develop prosecutions outside of Guatemala and Spain that I think Freddie referenced earlier. And obviously, Kate, you've been quite heavily involved in some of these processes. Can you talk a little bit about what those efforts for accountability look like now and what challenges they face?
Yes. The kind of principle upon which the work that we do in Guatemala is based is that the right to know is linked inexorably to the human rights and justice struggle. So you can't have human rights and justice advances without society's access to an understanding of what happened. That has become a campaign for us in Latin America, and particularly in Guatemala. The campaign focuses on the obligations of the state, and specifically the security institutions of the state, the military, the police, the intelligence services, the paramilitaries, to provide their documents or open their historical records for human rights purposes. This can be linked simply to the desire of families to know what happened and to see it in black and white. It can be linked to official truth-seeking processes or entities like commissions, but it could also be linked to, and has increasingly over the last decade been linked to, actual criminal cases or international cases in courts like the Spanish National Court or the Inter-American Court, where you don't have criminal charges, but you have human rights charges against the state as a whole. So bit by bit, we've been introducing first, again, the sort of declassified record into these cases. When you're talking about embassy cables, of course, you're not talking about direct criminal evidence, but you are talking about kind of corroborative evidence or contextual information that prosecutors need to make their case, and in places like Mexico or Guatemala, they don't have that. I wanted to read an excerpt from two cables that the U.S. Embassy sent to Washington, to the State Department, in 1982. They, I think, give you a good glimpse into the kind of information that the embassy had at that time about what was happening, and also tell us a lot about the U.S. role in assisting the cover-up and in helping the Guatemalan government, which, although it wasn't being funded by us, we still supported in many different ways, helping them hide some of their worst crimes. About 2 weeks after the massacre, the embassy received a visit from someone who was a source for them on previous occasions for information. And he brought to them detailed information about what appeared to be an army massacre in a place called Dos Herres, which they had never heard of until he came. And in that initial cable that they sent to the State Department before they had really investigated, it was really just reacting to what he told them. They conveyed to Washington that witnesses have seen that the village of Dos Serres is now completely deserted. They claim to have found burnt cédulas, or ID cards, in the Roman Catholic Church. The houses are empty. They claim the army came in after the massacre and took roofing and furniture to the army base at Las Cruces, which is the nearby army base in the Petén. And one of the three theories that this source, this reliable source who is not named in the document but is characterized as someone they've used before, about what happened at Dos Serres, again, in this initial cable sent to Washington, is that the army killed everyone in the village, dumped them into the well, and covered the well over. This last theory is based on the word of people who have gone into the village and seen that the well is covered over. They have been afraid to look into it. Though no bodies have been found, all the people have disappeared. Because of the seriousness of the information provided by the witness, and because the State Department at this precise moment was actually pressuring the US Embassy in Guatemala to review its reporting techniques and come up with some better ways to report what was happening in that country, because human rights organizations were constantly bringing evidence of massacres happening all over the country, and the embassy was repeatedly denying, both publicly and in its secret cables to Washington, that these massacres were being carried out by the military. Rather, the embassy stated over and over again that the massacres were probably carried out by guerrillas dressed to appear to be soldiers. Because of that pattern of reporting that in no way matched all the other sources that were flowing into Washington from the church, from the newspapers, from the human rights organization, and from witnesses and survivors that had fled to refugee camps in Mexico and other places, the State Department, just weeks before this cable was produced, had written a secret memo ordering the embassy to review its reporting practices because something didn't gel in the lack of information coming out of Guatemala from US officials about the military's role. And I'll just read a short excerpt from the second and last cable to show you, again, kind of the level of what they knew and how far they went to try to get it for once. They did actually take a helicopter and fly to Dos Serres. They had wanted to land in Dos Serres to see for themselves on the ground what had happened. When they went through the base in the Petén, which is near Dos Serres, the operations officer at the base told them that there had been a massacre. It was unfortunate, but the guerrillas had killed everybody in the town of Dos Serres. They then went towards Dos Serres, and as they got there, the Guatemalan military helicopter pilot refused to land, saying it was too dangerous. But he did fly over it, and they saw from the helicopter that all of the houses in this area were deserted. Many had been razed or destroyed by fire. Although the helicopter pilot refused to touch down, he did agree, however, to sweep low over the area. There were no signs of life. And finally, they went to Las Cruces, the base that was nearby, and they got from several sources information about the military having carried out a sweep of that area on the night or the nights of the Dos Serres killing. One of them was a member of a civil defense patrol and an apparent confidant of the army in the area. He told mission members that the army was responsible for the disappearance of the people of Dos Serres. He stated that he was told to keep out of the area on a certain day because the army was going to sweep through. The army, he said, had indeed done so, and whatever had happened to the people there had happened to them at the hands of the army. The source said the army swept through the area in civilian dress but wearing standard issue combat boots and carrying Galil rifles. The cable finally concludes with the embassy's analysis that the Guatemalan army was responsible for the massacre in Dos Serres. This information was first made public outside of secret channels between the embassy and Washington in 1998 in response to a FOIA request that I sent from the National Security Archive. So, the embassy knew at the time of the massacre that the army had been responsible. The embassy knew when the Argentines arrived in 1994 and 95 to exhume the well and then the fields surrounding the village and found dozens of bodies, that the army was responsible. The embassy knew when two Kaibiles came forward and began to talk to members of the prosecutor's office and Aura Elena Farfan from Famdegua, a human rights organization, that the army was responsible. But the embassy said nothing. So the cover-up is something that, you know, doesn't happen only at the hands of the perpetrators themselves, but of many different complicit institutions and entities. And I think the U.S. Shares that responsibility.
Thanks, Kate. There's many other questions that we could follow up with, and perhaps there'll be an opportunity to talk about what is in Guatemala also a model for openness of security archives in the police archives, which you've also been involved in, and the records from those archives have also been quite critical for some of the investigations and prosecutions that are ongoing. But I'm going to turn to Scott now, whose eagerness to jump into this and effectiveness at seeing the asylum application through, and I'm sure not the end of the story, has already been described by several of the presenters. Can you describe how you got into this this whole story and also how it has affected your life and your perception of these events?
Well, is this on? Freddie more or less described how I got to know him and the events that sort of led up to my introduction to Oscar and his remarkable case. And I have to say that it's one of the most amazing experiences of my life to be part of a process that takes this incredible tragedy and at Dos Aires in December 1982 and after 30 years, reunites two survivors of this massacre in such a remarkable way. The case is important, though, in a lot of other ways. One is Oscar's political asylum case. Oscar, in many ways, is an archetypical or archetypal Guatemalan undocumented alien. He came up here in 1999 after the woman he thought was his grandmother had died. I asked him once, you know, why he left this little village that he grew up happily in called Zacapa in central Guatemala. And he said, because I had nothing to look forward to for the rest of my life except picking cantaloupes. And those of you, and I know there are many here who know the history of Guatemala, know that in 1954, the CIA overthrew an elected president and did so at the behest of an American company called the United Fruit Company, which grows those cantaloupes. And that event and our support for a succession of corrupt, brutal military governments after that have created the political and economic conditions that have driven people like Oscar and according to the Pew Foundation, about 900,000 other Guatemalans up here who are now here undocumented, just as Oscar was. A year after Oscar arrived, a woman he knew from his village, Nidia, a wonderful woman, came up here and they met each other in Framingham, where she ended up, and they got together and they had four beautiful children over a 10-year period before I encountered them. Two girls, 11 and 7, a little boy who was 5 when I first met them, and a cute little baby called Dulce, who's now about 11 months. And in figuring out how to get political asylum for Oscar, there were a number of obstacles, one of the chief of which was that he had been here for 10 years, and as a lot of you know, you have to apply for political asylum within 1 year of your arrival. And that can be an insurmountable obstacle for a lot of people who have waited longer than that, but still have the kind of background and experience that Oscar has had that qualifies them for asylum. So that and other obstacles were things we had to overcome. And nothing has thrilled me more in life to be able to be part of a case where somebody as deserving as Oscar and Nidia and their four kids have been given asylum in the United States, and I can only say that I think a good case could be made for a lot of the 800,000 or 900,000 other Guatemalans who are living here who came for the same reasons. They're all victims of the economic and social conditions that we helped create beginning in 1954. Oscar's case is important in another really important way. The Caibiles, who were responsible for this atrocity in December 1982, have been the subject of a remarkable series of legal events in Guatemala that have demonstrated what civil society and government agencies who have an interest and will in bringing justice to these kinds of cases can accomplish. And the remarkable thing is that they did it all on their own. This wasn't like the United States government swooping down and giving institutions millions of dollars as they did in El Salvador to try and create a justice system and didn't succeed at it. In the last 3 years, five Caibiles have been convicted by Guatemalan courts and Guatemalan prosecutors for their role in the Dos Aires massacre and sentenced to over 5,000 years in jail each, 30 years for each of the 201 murders that have been established in these cases. And as a lawyer looking at these cases, it is a marvelous construction of criminal prosecutions that has depended on this amazingly unique and successful partnership of civil society, groups like Freddie's Forensic Anthropology Foundation that through science has developed exhumed bodies and developed forensic evidence that has helped prosecutors make these cases, and more remarkably, civil society groups that have tracked down witnesses who are essential to any kind of prosecution like this, living witnesses. And these cases were made possible because two ex-Caibiles were found by an NGO in Guatemala called FAMDEGUA, which was it's the NGO started to pursue the interests of the families of disappeared people. And the efforts of a remarkable woman named Aurelena Farfan, who heard that there was an ex-Caibil who was involved in the Dos Aires massacre who wanted to talk. And she tracked this guy down, and he led her to a second member of the Caibiles who also wanted to talk. And these two guys, whose names are Pinzon and Ibanez, became cooperating witnesses. They took these two witnesses to, in 1997 was a young prosecutor, she's an older woman now, named Sarah Romero. Sarah Romero is the woman who, over a 15-year period, succeeded in tracking down Oscar Ramirez, and last August, sent him that email that persuaded him to take the DNA test that established that he was the son of Tranquilino Castaneda, creating another link in the proof that has helped convict five Caibiles to date and will, I think, convict a number of others in the future. But this was an amazing partnership that I haven't seen anywhere in Latin America. I've been working on justice systems in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Chile and Argentina, and it's just an absolutely remarkable example of how people with the will and the energy and the desire to bring to justice soldiers responsible for crimes like this can really accomplish. I just want, part of my role in this case is to make sure that all of the elements of our government know just exactly how important this model that's been created in Guatemala is, and that we learn something from it, and that we help the Guatemalans continue this story of success, because there are a lot of political forces that are obviously upset by this. And as these convictions of Caibiles in the Dos Aires case mount, they're going right up the chain of command. And of course, the top of the pyramid is former President Rios Montt, who has been charged in these cases. So the cases in the Spanish National Court are important, but there's nothing more important than the prosecutions actually going on in Guatemala today. And I think they're hugely important models and for the entire hemisphere, particularly the Central American region, where the United States government has a big interest in creating justice systems that actually work. We can actually end up with a justice system in Guatemala that has capacities that we haven't seen in any other country, and these cases are sort of lighting the way towards that end. There's one other element of these cases that Kate touched on, which is the complicity of the United States government. And I just want to mention one thing. She read that cable from an embassy officer that was written in the closing days of 1982, I think December 30th, 1982. And I was recently, I recently learned about a trip that a good friend of mine, some of you know him, Chris Dickey, made to a little village in Guatemala a few days after that cable was written. And he had heard reports of killings by the army of people in a village called Puhu Hill. And he went there from his base in San Salvador to investigate it. And he went to a cemetery, which is a typical Central American campesino cemetery with a lot of handmade wooden crosses. And there were kids playing. And there was a man who was putting flowers by a handmade wooden cross. And the man was a mute, and he could not speak. But the children understood what he was saying. And he was obviously very emotional. And he came over to Chris, and he learned that Chris was there through hand signals, you know, trying to figure out what had happened to the people that were buried in the cemetery. And the man started crying and kissing Chris's hands. And the children were telling him, he's saying, the army ate my children. And Chris wrote this incredibly moving article called A Guatemalan Village's Agony. If you go to the Washington Post archive, you can find it. It's published on January 4, 1983. And I was reading it a couple of weeks ago, thinking about that cable that Kate dug up. In that article, it reports that Chris went to the embassy, the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala City, and asked questions about the Army's responsibility for this and other atrocities that had been reported by Amnesty International, which was then really the only international human rights group that was really covering Guatemala in any systematic way. And there was an officer in the embassy whose job it was to respond to questions from reporters about the amnesty reports and allegations that the government was responsible for atrocities. And he would give these written replies that what Amnesty International was publishing were Marxist lies. Chris put that in that report, and it was written 4 days after the cable that the embassy officer sent to Washington reporting that I can only conclude that the Guatemalan military murdered the entire village of Dos Aires. So the complicity of the United States government and understanding and digging up all the facts and finding the names of the people who were responsible for this and you know, clearing the record of our role in these terrible events is an important part of what we're doing here today. And it relates to the Dos Aires case in another respect, because we've discovered, and the Justice Department and the State Department have discovered to their chagrin, that over the years, a number of Caibiles involved in these massacres have come to the United States. Several of them have gotten citizenship. And last year, a Caibil found living in Florida, who had become a citizen, was prosecuted for naturalization fraud and sentenced to a 10-year prison term. There's a second guy named Sosa Arantes, whose case is now pending in California. He was recently extradited from Canada, where he fled after being arrested in California for immigration fraud. That case, Freddie and Tranquilino, his father, will be witnesses in. That's the case that, Oscar and his father, Tranquilino. That's the case that Oscar was talking about when we met with the Justice Department. It's being prosecuted right now. And Kate and Freddie are witnesses in this case. And these are important gestures, not just symbolic gestures, but important gestures by the United States government to, I think, undo some of our complicity in the atrocities that occurred in Guatemala in the 1980s. And they're steps that we all have to sort of take note of and, you know, encourage our government to continue. They're not easy steps, and prosecutions like this are difficult. They have to find eyewitnesses. They have one additional Kaibil who is cooperating in the prosecution there, and it's going to be an interesting case to watch. And I hope all of you who are interested in these cases follow it. It's in the Central District of California, United States versus Jorge Sosa Arantes. Anyway, it's been a great privilege working with Freddie and Kate, and a huge honor for me to get to know Oscar and his family, his wife Nidia, and his four kids, and being involved with this incredible opportunity to, you know, bring some relief to victims of one of the worst atrocities that has occurred in our continent.
Thank you, Scott. One follow-up question for you before we open it up to questions from the audience. You referenced the really impressive and quite unique prosecution for genocide of former dictator Rios Montt and other former generals. And the prosecutions of former Kaibiles. There was also in August a conviction of a former police chief for crimes against humanity. To what do you attribute this unique moment and these, you know, aggressive and effective prosecutions in Guatemala?
Well, the civil society groups, FAMDEGUA, the people who run them, Mara Aura Elena Farfan, and people like Freddie Petrarelli, who and the Foundation for Forensic Anthropology, are key players in all of this, but also the Attorney General of Guatemala, Claudia Paz y Paz, who has been the leader in these prosecutions and is another huge example for what can be done when world pressure forces a government to put in place a prosecutor like she is, who has the skill and the political will to pursue these cases. And this is a critical moment in Guatemalan history. The new president, Perez Molina, comes out of the military. He made an early decision to take a few steps that were very encouraging to the human rights community. He signed the Treaty of Rome. Guatemala is now a part of the International Criminal Court process. He has continued Claudia Paz y Paz as the fiscal general of Guatemala, and so that these prosecutions will continue. And he's doing that for a reason. He wants Guatemala to become a legitimate state and to end its history of being the pariah of Central America. And all of these are important steps, I think, that he feels, you know, are politically necessary in order to accomplish that. And we have to continue policies in this government, that our own government, that continue to apply the pressure to maintain this course and these prosecutions and build on them and make Guatemala into the model that it might one day be for the rest of the region.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks to this incredible panel. We have a very distinguished panel, and I know that we have a very distinguished audience, to some who have many, many years of work in Guatemala or in Latin America and on some of these issues. So we have half an hour for questions, and I would invite people to line up behind the mic here if you have a question you'd like to ask. Please introduce yourself as well.
My name is Malcolm Arnold. Thank you very much. My question is for Kate, maybe Scott. Based upon everything that you've read, as far as all the reports that you've gotten through the Freedom of Information Act, what would you speculate as far as what the motivations for the U.S. at this time versus 1954 in supporting these atrocities, or enabling these atrocities to occur? And then also, what was the structural support that the U.S. government was giving to the Guatemalan government to carry them out?
The support from the United States of the Rios Montt government, which was in power at the time of the Dos Heres massacre, very much took place within the context of sort of the strategic interests of the United States in Central America at the time. And as everyone remembers, the Sandinistas had won in Nicaragua in 1979, and the U.S. was really kind of on alert for the creep of communism up the isthmus into Texas, as Reagan said several times very explicitly. And everything that went on in Central America sort of was subsumed within those strategic interests. So the U.S. had a secret Contra war operating on the border with Honduras and Nicaragua. The U.S. was heavily invested with millions and millions of dollars, ultimately billions of dollars, in the war in El Salvador by supporting the military quite openly. And the U.S. wanted Guatemala to be our partner on that strategic mission. The problem is that Guatemala was a pariah around the world and inside the United States. I mean, Congress had, long before Jimmy Carter and the Congress in the 1970s, had cut off aid to Guatemala. So Reagan didn't have the option of opening the faucet up again and supporting in that way. What Reagan did do, and what every successive president did until President Clinton, who was the president that kind of found out that this was going on, was continue to pour millions of dollars into Guatemala through the CIA. So the overt funding was cut off by order of Congress, but the covert funding continued well into the 1990s. Structurally, in terms of how we supported that project, really the US since the early 1960s was there sitting at the table with the military governments, helping them design a more powerful and more efficient counterinsurgency machine. We helped build their military intelligence almost from the ground up. We helped create, with our funding and training, a what became, years later, a notorious death squad unit called the Archivo, which was also part of the Guatemalan military structure. So we contributed through decades to helping to build the army into the machine it became. And then in the 1980s, we continued that support, but in a covert way.
I just want to add to that a little anecdote. Today at lunch, Ana Arana and I were having lunch with a friend of hers named Bill Orm, who in 1979 was Time Magazine's stringer in Guatemala. And Bill related a story. He personally witnessed in a square in a little town, Mennonite community near Guatemala City, the murder, the beating to death of a young man who was North American, half Mennonite, half American, who had angered somebody in the military. He was beaten to death by military people in front of a lot of witnesses to make him an example. And Bill wrote a piece for Time, and he sent it up, and they said, we can't publish this. And he said, why not? And he said, because there's no American connection. I mean, Jimmy Carter has cut off military assistance, and there's just no, it's just a local story. I mean, it's a terrible thing, but it's a local story. And that's why all this was secret. And that's what made Guatemala the unusual place, because they kept it secret and covert. And everything that was happening in El Salvador was in the newspapers because we were openly supporting the government there. But, you know, Guatemala's military escaped this kind of scrutiny because our government collaborated with them in keeping it a secret. And we have to go back and look at that and find out who is responsible. And we have to start examining what we're doing today. There's a lot of secret, you know, I'm getting into other things, but all of these are things that occurred in the past, but they carry important lessons for the present.
Stephen Schlesinger, one of the things that should be added is that the Guatemalan government in the last year or so has recognized Jacobo Arbenz as a historic figure in the Guatemalan changes that occurred in 1954. As you know, they were, once Arbenz was overthrown by the U.S., by the CIA, he disappeared as far as the history books of Guatemala were concerned. So I think that's one of the, another instance of progress besides what the new president is doing. Also, the U.S. did, in a kind of indirect way, through President Clinton, apologize for what had happened in 1954 in a visit he made in 1999, I think, to Guatemala. He implicitly tried to apologize for what the U.S. had, the bloody deed that the U.S. had committed back in 1954. But anyway, the question I had was, I wasn't quite clear. Is it the fact that the two military men who had been involved in the massacre turned out to be willing to talk about it? Is that what the breakthrough that enabled everything to be uncovered? Was that the linkage that brought about Oscar's
Yes, because, well, you need eyewitnesses in order to validly make convictions. You can either get confessions or eyewitnesses. And these two guys who were willing to talk were discovered, and Guatemala invented their own witness protection program. I mean, they don't do this anywhere else in Central America, but it's an essential way to make a case like this. So they from personal testimony, can identify everybody involved in that massacre. And the other witnesses are just victims. I mean, they can't identify who was there and what they were doing. But these two guys can. And the Guatemalans gave them a protected witness status. And that's never been done in the hemisphere. And that's how these cases were made. Now, there's a third guy that they're going to use in the California prosecution of Soso Rantes for naturalization fraud. But that's the way these cases were made. And
how was the case made that Oscar had been adopted by this particular family?
Oh, that was the fortuitous event of Famdegua, Aura Elena Farfan. The two witnesses, part of their testimony was that on that day, two boys were kidnapped. And that became an element of the story and an important element in the prosecutions, because Aura Elena and Sara Romero, this young prosecutor, realized that if you could validate that testimony and find these two boys, it would corroborate the other testimony of the two cooperating witnesses. So they set out immediately in about 1997 to find the boys. One of these boys was living in Guatemala with the guy who kidnapped him, a sergeant. And they tracked him down and established that that's who he was, because the sergeant admitted it, and the boy remembered. He was five, and he knew he had been kidnapped. They took him to Canada and gave him political asylum there, and he's been a witness, an eyewitness, in a lot of these prosecutions because he remembered what he saw. It took them about 12 years to find Oscar, because he had been kidnapped by a Kabyle lieutenant who took him home to his mother and said, "This is a kid that a woman hands my child, but she doesn't want him." And then he died a year later. Oscar grew up with this woman, and there was nobody around to sort of connect him with the event. And it was only the sort of miraculous discovery of this 70-year-old campesino who one day wandered into a Famdegua meeting where relatives of the victims of Dos Aires were meeting, and Aura Elena Farfan met him, and she got to know all of these people. And then later on, when photographs of the kid they thought might be the 3-year-old kidnapped boy, she thought there was a resemblance between this guy Tranquilino and this boy. That was one of the elements. That's why when Freddie went to Framingham, he had DNA samples, two DNA samples to compare Oscar's sample with. One was Ramiro, the boy in Canada, who was the 5-year-old kidnapped boy, and the other was this 70-year-old campesino, but there was nothing else connecting him. And if that connection hadn't been made, or Tranquilino hadn't been away the day of the massacre, there would have been no way to scientifically establish that Oscar is who he is. It's one of these incredibly amazing, serendipitous, or miraculous, depending on how you want to characterize it, events in this whole episode, that we know now who Oscar is, and his existence is evidence that the testimony of these two Caibiles is truthful.
Thanks very much.
As Jennifer moves to the microphone, I do want to say, for those of you who might be interested in following up on some of the stories that we've been telling and some of the history that we've been talking about, Steve Schlesinger just happens to be the co-author with Stephen Kinzer of the definitive and truly great book about the coup against Arbenz in 1954 called Bitter Fruit. So please do look that up. It's an amazing book.
You didn't say that.
Too modest.
My name is Jennifer Harbury, and first and foremost, I'd like to certainly thank Freddie and all of FAFE for the amazing work they've done in my husband's case. My husband was disappeared and tortured to death in Guatemala back in the early 90s, and it was FAFE that consistently took their life in their hands, literally trying to, you know, locate the mass graveyard where we believe that he was buried. What I'd like to mention just very briefly today is an ongoing whitewash that's happening right now with respect to President or General Otto Perez Molina, if I may. As you know, he's now a general. He's also the recently elected president of Guatemala. He was a major in the early 1980s. In 1982, he was based in the Ichil Triangle and was a major. He was part of the intelligence division, and he was in charge of a base near the Nabok region where there were village-by-village massacres, very much like what you've been hearing about Dos Aires, happening on an ongoing basis. He's, in fact, appeared in a video with Alan Nairn, standing over the bloodied bodies of 3 dead prisoners of war, using the false name of Arturo Arias, or Tito Arias, excuse me, and that name also appears in Plan Sofia. In 1992, he became the head of the intelligence division, or G2, and was directly responsible for the 3 years of torture and eventual assassination of my husband. My husband was a special prisoner of a special G2 project, intelligence project. It was a top secret project. The idea was to torture those people long-term, secretly, so that there would be no international human rights outcry. The goal was not to kill them, but to break them psychologically so that they would share all of their information. Other branches of the military could know nothing about those prisoners. They were transported in intelligence vehicles. They were kept in different army bases in intelligence compounds only. They were dressed in civilian clothes, so other military people would not understand that they were prisoners. They were tortured by intelligence prisoners, and he himself spent 2 periods of several months at a time in the capital in a top-secret compound that was run by the intelligence division's secret death squad that was dedicated to wiping out insurgents and also anyone like Aura Elena Farfan, for example, people who were leading the human rights groups. The leadership in that group, according to a prisoner who was able to escape and give me all of the information, reported on a near daily basis to the head of intelligence, who was Otto Perez Molina, the current president. After I carried out three hunger strikes, some of you may remember that under President Clinton, there was the shocking news that my husband had been killed at the hands of a number of people who were also working as paid CIA informants. One of the names that filtered out eventually, of course, was Otto Perez Molina. But after the Truth Commission report came out by the UN, President Clinton did have the courage and decency to apologize to the people of Guatemala for what all of the people on this panel have been saying tonight, which is the complicity between our government and the military wiped out in Guatemala. So I was fairly shocked the other day to hear that, in fact, Mr. Clinton just honored Otto Perez Molina at the UN. So we will have some of these flyers out for everyone. There is an ongoing push to renew military aid to Guatemala under Otto Perez Molina, under the claim that he's the great reformist. In fact, the war crimes trials are going downhill in a hurry since he came to power. Although the Dos Eres case was fantastic just before he was elected against low-level caibiles, as soon as they tried to indict Rios Montt, the series of amparos that have been declared illegal by the Inter-American Court have started again and again and again. The same kind of frustration is happening for people pushing the genocide case. In my own case, I brought the evidence to the prosecutor's office and they wanted to go with it. Everyone was willing, but we were called into a secret hearing. My lawyer was not told what case it was. He was just told to appear. And when he appeared, the judge told him that the investigation was being canceled before it started, despite inter-American orders. And when he asked for a day, 24 hours, to prepare a response, he was told he couldn't have it. So we filed the materials and appealed, and the judge would not send it up on appeal. The peace archives have been closed. They're gone. We can't get into them anymore. The highest levels of the cabinet are people who were with Otto Perez Molina during the 80s at high-level positions in the military that was carrying out that genocide. So if any of you would like to send a message to Bill Clinton, we'd be very appreciative. We think that this needs to not get whitewashed again. The violence against human rights leaders is going right straight up once again.
Thanks, Jennifer. Since this didn't come out so explicitly in the panel discussion, I'd like to follow that up with the question of how has the political climate changed, in particular with regard to some of the truth and justice measures that we've been talking about from the experience of people on the panel? Anyone who wants to take that question?
Well, the key issue right now, and this has been true since Perez Molina took office in January, is that even before he was sworn in as president during the campaign in 2011, he stated very explicitly, directly, and I would even say aggressively, that there has been no genocide in Guatemala. What has happened in terms of the kind of narrative that is being woven now by the military, by retired military officers who are now in, they have their associations, their professional associations, and they speak out and go on marches in the streets under the banner of those associations, by Perez Molina himself and by his cabinet members, is that there were, in fact, massacres. Something that, until about a year ago, simply was not discussed by those kinds of people. There was a sort of a massacre denial going on for many, many years that has now been superseded by a genocide denial. So we can talk about the fact that there were massacres now, and Perez Molina, in a very important interview, public interview during his campaign, did talk about just that, that unfortunately the guerrillas went into areas where there were women and children and used those women and children as part of their revolutionary project, and unfortunately those women and children were caught up in the violence and were killed. And sometimes that happened at the hands of the military. That was very new that he was able to say that, so that made news. What he also said in that conversation and has now kind of put forward very aggressively time and time again in public fora is that there may have been massacres, but there was no genocide. And genocide is the crime which Rios Montt, the former military governor, has been charged with. And genocide will be the crime that other members of the armed forces will be charged with if these cases go ahead. So there's, I would say, a sophisticated new tactic on the part of the Guatemalan government to, on the one hand, permit the continued operations of this crusading and truly marvelous Attorney General, Claudia Paz, and on the other hand, start creating new strategies to undermine the very cases that she's putting together. One is the genocide denial, and the other is a new talk about the possibility of a some kind of renewed amnesty or pardon, something that, you know, hasn't been discussed really since the peace accord. So it's a very tricky moment. It's a very tricky moment, and it's easy to see Perez Molina as a reformer because, for example, of his support for Claudia Paz, because he's taken a lot of the right public steps. At the same time, there is this complicated, I would say, strategy, a parallel strategy on the part of that government to find ways to essentially stop these trials.
That, to me, what Freddie Pecorelli told me tonight about that award that Clinton bestowed on Perez Molina, and I was really shocked. And what it underscores is how ignorant most North Americans are, not the people in this room, but most North Americans are, including former presidents, about the recent history of Guatemala, and they have not read Steve's book, and they were not awake that morning in social studies in ninth grade when they heard about what the CIA did in 1954. And I think it begins with Bill Clinton. I think we have to start educating North Americans about this whole era and our own government's complicity in this thing. We have to do it in very visible ways. That's why I was really glad when I got to know Oscar and I got involved with these efforts that Ana Arana, who's in this room, and others who were writing for Publica, and then they took it to This American Life. You know, 2 or 3 million people heard the story of Oscar on This American Life and then heard the story of the Dos Aires Massacre. And we have to keep these educational efforts going. And that may sound stupid, but when Bill Clinton doesn't know, you know, who he's giving a prize to, it's a reflection of this larger problem of North American ignorance of events in Guatemala that we have to correct. Because he can get away with it, because nobody around him is saying, you know, nobody's sending him telegrams and saying, what are you doing? And he's not asked to account for it. Yeah, no, I mean, this is important. I think it's important.
Freddie, I want to give you an opportunity to speak, too, about how the changing political climate is affecting the work that you're engaged in.
Let's see. Everything that was said tonight here is true. Kate has a very in-depth read on what's happening in Guatemala. She's there often, and she's working with us and many other organizations as well. One of the things that is happening, that's why I wanted to show you the military base, and I think it's important because the excuse for the communities is not, you can't use it for the military bases. You got to remember, I mean, the excuse was they were using women and children as shields in the massacres, in the communities, during combats. These are not combats. These are military installations. People were brought in with a specific purpose. And now we're finding dozens of graves. We've actually found over 1,000 bodies in about 27 different military installations. about half of them come from this one military base. And we don't know how many bodies we're going to find there. That's what we've found so far, 409 bodies, among them women and children as well. But these people were taken in. I mean, there's even, we have testimony, this witness said that there was a pickup brought in full of people, and they were shot up. The grave was dug next to the truck, next to this pickup truck, and then they were put in the grave, and we found the pickup truck. It was, it's there. We haven't dug the grave yet. But these are, this evidence is corroborating all of this testimony over and over and over again. There was a newspaper article in El Periódico where what the Spanish newspaper reporter working in Guatemala traced down one of the commanders of this military base and asked him what had happened. And his excuse was that there was people living there working on the base, and as they died, they were buried in this community graves. And there were blindfolds and, you know, hands and feet tied and gunshot wounds to the head. But when she went to other commanders that were also there, their excuse was exactly the same. So you can see that they're getting ready for, this is the new cover-up. This is the new excuse. Now they go, oh yeah, there's bodies in the military graves. So those are workers that died. So this has been an ongoing process for each one of the findings as these are brought to light and they're beginning to be used as evidence in trials. There's always an official excuse for why it happened. And so far, the interesting thing is that I keep expecting the United Nations, because it's a United Nations peacekeeping military base, to just close it down. I mean, it's run by the Guatemalan army. And I just don't understand how come there's not a movement around these military installations. And these are permanent military installations. There are, I want to say hundreds, there might be more than hundreds, of temporary installations. For example, there's an article, I think it must have been 1997, that came out on the front page of the New York Times. We were working in a community called San Andres Sacabajá. We worked inside of the Catholic Church. And we would dig wherever there was floor missing from the floor of the church. And sure enough, mass grave after mass grave after mass grave inside the Catholic Church, because that's what the military had occupied temporarily while they were running their operations in San Andres Acabaja, in Rabinal, in the school. The wells in the schools, full of bodies. And so on and so forth. And you could see in Comalapa, military base an hour and a half outside of Guatemala City, we recovered 220 bodies in 53 graves between 2003 and 2004. That's where we found six victims that show up in the military diary that was given to Kate. Victims that were captured during six different dates in six different locations in Guatemala City. We find them all inside of the same grave, inside of the same military installation. And the interesting thing is they all had annotations in their file that said 300 with the same date, the 29th of March, 1984. So they were captured on different dates, captured on different locations, found in the same grave, and all executed on the same day. And you can trace the evidence. So this is a strategy of getting rid of people, not only in the communities, but also at an individual level. And I'm just surprised that this is not in the newspapers every day, and this, you know, and even the UN. I'm very surprised at the UN. We work with UNDP. Our project is a UNDP project. Nonetheless, they are still there. And, you know, they're training peacekeepers over graves.
Hi. Time, I think, for the last two questions. Did you want to say something?
No, I just was going to have her do her questions.
Hi, I'm Katie Haas, and I had a question about the prosecutions in Guatemala. So you explained that the process has been to sort of start with lower-level caipiles and try to work your way up. And I know in some other nations it's been a different tactic of trying to start at the top, such as in Argentina with the junta trials, and try to work your way down. And I was wondering what you thought were the comparative advantages or disadvantages of those two strategies to achieving the goal of accountability.
I don't think there was any conscious decision to do it this way, but I think they found this case and these two witnesses, and they put it together. And, you know, everybody else has spoken about, you know, what's going on here, which is a concerted effort by a very dedicated prosecutor who is operating in ways that political forces in Guatemala are very opposed to, but she's getting away with it because of a lot of international pressure. And, you know, whether it starts from the bottom and goes up or the top and goes down, you know, both of these are essential elements of accomplishing justice. And I haven't seen anything as comprehensive in any other part of this hemisphere, and certainly Argentina is hardly an example. And when you look at the thousands of people who were involved in all of those disappearances at all sorts of levels, and only a handful of generals spent a very small amount of time in jail. So, you know, and what I'm hearing is that we really have a lot of work to do to create the political will that will, you know, make it impossible for people like Bill Clinton to hand out awards to presidents like Perez Molina and feel like he's getting away from it. And I don't know what's going on in Bill Clinton's head. It's really hard to imagine. And I do remember that, yes, he was the president at that time, and he had a lot of other things going on, good and bad. And I remember when I was working on the church women's case. I've been working on this case for about 30 years, and we were trying to get some documents out of the State Department in 1998. And I remember encountering real opposition and meeting a friend of mine, Greg Craig, who was then briefly the Undersecretary of State for Policy and Planning. And I said, Greg, we haven't been able to get this evidence in the church women's case out of the State Department. It's been classified since 1984. And he looked at me and he said, what are you talking about? ARA, which is the bureau in the State Department that covers the Western Hemisphere, it's the same as it always was. Just because Bill Clinton's the president doesn't mean anything's different. And that's the sad fact, that a lot of the people who were involved in those days in these cases are still there now. Bill Branfield, the Assistant Secretary of State for Narcotics Enforcement, was a young political lawyer in the embassy in San Salvador in 1982. I went on my first trip down there for the church women's case. And a lot of these people are still there. And that's one of the obstacles to accomplishing anything that relates to this hemisphere. And I'm telling you, Bill Clinton doesn't pay much attention to Central America or Latin America at all. He doesn't really know much about it. And while he should, and he should certainly know about Jennifer's case, and it's shocking that he does these things, we've got to start holding people accountable for that. And I mean North Americans, and I mean government officials. And, you know, that's got to be part of our agenda.
Yes, I have Marcia Esparza from the Historical Memory Project. I was part of the Truth Commission in Guatemala from 1997 to 1999. I was in El Quiché, where I interviewed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of war survivors. So I bear witness to the Guatemalan genocide. And I want to say a couple of things about the political climate. I think that we are in a memory crisis right now that is very, very dangerous for Guatemalan historical memory. The fact that Otto Perez Molina is denying the genocide has tremendous consequences. One thing that I think that denial, cover up is one thing, denial is another thing. I mean, after having worked for the Truth Commission and learning that Otto Perez Molina got an award, I just think that this is, I just can't believe it. This is just too much for me, really. I never imagined that I was going to witness what happened this week here in New York City. About the United Nations, I think that we need to tell the United Nations that they should not enlist the Kabylists or any force from military armies that are genocidal armies, because then they are sent, the Kabylists, to Haiti and Congo and reproduce the same atrocities that they have learned. So we have to be very, very aware that the United Nations enlists people from genocidal armies and is getting away with it. And I also want to say, having been part of the Truth Commission, I think the Truth Commission they begin to scratch the surface of what happened. But we need archives, we need exhumation, we need money for exhumation, we need money for archives, we need more awards for people like Freddie and Kate, we need awards for people like Jennifer, because we just know a little bit. Or more, I mean, if we had the resources, perhaps we could learn more. I just give you a brief example of what I mean. When I was part of the Truth Commission, as I said, I was in El Quiché, where half of the 626 massacres took place. And I met my favorite bombero, firefighter, from this small town. The firefighters are one of the few institutions that arrived and have connections with communities at the village level. So what the firefighters did during the genocide, 1981 to 1983, was to keep a log of all the corpses, all the bodies that they picked up in this area. So he gave me the 3 years for the genocide. So we have now, the Historical Memory Project has now a local archive, and there's no denial. There were most bodies were killed we are analyzing this data. We did an incredible database. I have behind me our research co-founder of the project, who is doing the Excel sheet and doing the bomberos data set, the firefighters data set. In 1982, over 600 bodies in Chichicastenango were picked up with gunshots, but also with machetes wounds, and also with strangulation and beaten to death. Why? If they were already dead, beaten up with machetes and strangled, why did they fire at them? And I think the only explanation is actually one of the ones that I'm reconciling with comes from the Truth Commission, racism. The role that racism, because this was a non-indigenous army recruiting indigenous people to go against their own people. And this was one of those most perversely conceived counterinsurgency campaigns in the whole hemisphere. By drawing the civil patrols that are getting, no one is mentioning the civil patrols, right? And they were the ones who gave away their own people so that the Kabylists could go in. Now, who were the civil patrols? Maya themselves. So I'm just making you aware of the need to respond to these memory crisis moments that we have right now, that we're going from cover-up to denial.
We've reached the end of the program, and I want to give the panelists an opportunity to say any final words, if you have final words that you want to share before we close this definitively, for the moment at least. Freddie?
Taking some of the information and putting it together and what Scott said, I really do think we're just now ready to begin to understand really what happened, and we finally have the capacity, the local capacity, to identify the individuals that are missing, to give back the bodies to the families, to give the evidence to the prosecution. And it's important, also, I didn't mention this before, but this is the first year that the prosecutor's office is actually coming to us to request investigations without legal NGOs pushing them. For the first time, the human rights section of the prosecution is asking us to conduct more and more and more exhumations in military bases. This had not happened before. All of the exhumations that happened in the past were pushed by CONAVIGUA, GAM, FANDEGUA, CALDEACHE, and many other organizations that have supported this work for 20 years. But now, the prosecutors have understood how important the scientific evidence is to corroborate the testimonies in these trials. I really do believe it's the beginning of a long haul. We always said that if you take the Truth Commission findings and say 200,000 victims, about 160,000 dead, 40,000 disappeared, let's say 1/4 of the dead are actually buried, which would be 40,000. We've recovered about 6,500 of those bodies. It still leaves about 33,500 bodies. At about 1,000 bodies a year, that's 33 and a half years of work to recover 1/4 of the bodies. And that's not even taking into account how long it would take to take, you know, 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 DNA samples of the families, actually about 1 million families, family members affected. If you take 5 family members per 200,000 victims, to put them into the DNA database and to compare that DNA, those DNA profiles, those family DNA profiles, with the DNA profiles of the skeletons. So we're talking about decades of work. And unfortunately, I'm hearing in the international community, the Dutch are closing their embassy in Guatemala. USAID is shifting from transitional justice to citizen security. Other organizations, private organizations, are looking at immigration issues, and it just seems like the window is beginning to close, mm-hmm. just when we're ready to begin to work at a different level. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Thanks, Freddie. Kate?
Well, I think from our perspective, there's two big jobs ahead. One is in Latin America to convince civil society first, and obviously governments second, that the right to truth, the right to know what happened, and the right to the documented record of government institutions that were involved in state terror is a part of any country's human rights project. And human rights organizations in these countries, in our own country and all around the Americas, have to take that on as one of their objectives, their human rights objectives. In this country, I would say, again, from our perspective, the real task now to me in terms of Guatemala is to, you know, we've gotten so many tens of thousands of amazing declassified documents. That's been very important. But there really has not been any kind of accountability, not even in terms of the sort of clarification of the past, as we say in Guatemala, of the U.S. officials that were involved. And you know, I don't expect there to be a U.S. Truth Commission. I don't expect there to ever be U.S. trials. But I do think that we need to kind of go to the next level, as you say, Freddie, and start naming these people and figure out, so who were the people in the embassy, and go interview these people and talk to them and get their testimonies, if you will, about how, for example, they could know what was happening in Dos Heres and never alert anybody, even though there was, you know, through Amnesty International, through America's Watch, and through the newspapers, there was an alarm about this massacre. People knew that something had happened. And why, you know, just a week after these cables were sent, in January of 1984, Reagan went back to Congress and asked again for a renewal of military aid, which was turned down. But why? Why? I'd like to dig deeper into that. That is my next challenge.
As always. Oscar, do you have some parting words?
I just want to thank everybody for being here, and I was like very impressed about what she said about the award that the president gave from Guatemala.
James Reston once wrote famously that Americans will do anything about Latin America, do anything for Latin America except read about it. And it reminded me that when I first met Steve Schlesinger, we were both in state government, 1980, I think, and that book had just come out about the Arbenz overthrow by the CIA, and I was thinking tonight, 1980, Oscar was 1 year old, the Dos Aires massacre was 2 years away. You know, if more people had read Stephen's book then and understood our complicity in what was going on, and more people in government were honest about what they knew was actually going on in Guatemala and that we were complicit in, it would be a different world, and Oscar's eight brothers and sisters might still be, and mother might still be alive. So we all have an obligation to change James Reston's famous observation about Latin America and Guatemala in particular, because we are all complicit. And we can all start with Bill Clinton next week.
So in addition to Bitter Fruit, which is highly recommended, I just want to also recognize some of the sources of this remarkable story as publicized in This American Life, What Happened at Dos Aires, and ProPublica's Finding Oscar piece, as well as the film Granito, which is quite exceptional, and you saw a couple of clips today. So with that, I want to thank...
And let me just add, Ana Arana, one of the authors of the ProPublica piece, who made three trips to Guatemala to interview all those people, is sitting here. Raise your hand, Ana.
And so I want to thank this incredible panel of speakers, as well as this really incredible audience, and sticking it out for a long night, but hopefully a very interesting one.